A monk asked Joshu in all earnestness, "Does a dog have Buddha nature or not?" Joshu said, "Moo." Uman's commentary. With the practice of Zen, you must pass through the barrier set up by the ancient masters of Zen. To attain to marvelous enlightenment, you must completely extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind. If you have not passed the barrier and have not extinguished all thoughts, you're a phantom haunting the weeds and trees. Now just tell me, what is the barrier of the patriarchs? Merely this Mu, the one barrier of our sect. So it has come to be called the gateless barrier of the Zen sect. Those who have passed the barrier are able not only to see Joshu face to face, but also to walk hand in hand with the whole descending line of patriarchs and be eyebrow to eyebrow with them. You will see with the same eye that they see, hear with the same ear that they hear with. Wouldn't it be a wonderful joy? Isn't there anyone who wants to pass this barrier? Then concentrate your whole self into this move, making your whole body, with its 360 bones and joints and 84,000 pores, into a solid lump of doubt. Day and night, without ceasing, keep digging into it. But don't take it as nothingness, or as being, or non-being. It must be like a red hot iron ball that you gulp down and which you try to vomit but can't. You must extinguish all delusive thoughts and beliefs which you have cherished up to the present. After a certain period of such efforts, Mu will come to fruition, and inside and out will become one naturally. You'll then be like a dumb man who has had a dream. You will know yourself and for yourself only. Then all of a sudden, Mu will break open. It will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. It will be just as if you had snatched the great sword of General Khan. If you meet a Buddha, you will kill him. If you meet a patriarch, you will kill him. Though you may stand on the brink of life and death, you'll enjoy the great freedom. In the six realms and the four modes of birth, you will live in the samadhi of innocent play. Now, how should you concentrate on Mu? Exhaust every ounce of energy you have in doing it. And if you do not give up on the way, you will be enlightened the way a candle in front of the altar is lighted by one touch of fire. The verse, dog, Buddha nature, the perfect manifestation, the absolute command. A little has or has not, and body is lost, life is lost. Well, that's dramatic. Even though we don't practice with Mu the way Joshu describes, or Mumon describes here, Mu remains a kind of paradigm of practice. And I'd like to discuss something about how it functions in this traditional way and contrast it with how it functions for us. The setup of the koan is a monk asking, does a dog have Buddha nature? And one, without too much of a leap, can imagine the monk in putting himself in the place of the dog. Do I have Buddha nature? But by making it a dog, it's creating as sort of the greatest seemingly possible gap between the two. And that must be, we would say, how the monk feels, a million miles away from anything as exalted as Buddha nature. And so the question is, how do you close that gap? Or where did that gap come from in the first place, might be the way we would frame that question. Joshu's Mu, presenting this barrier, is a way to engage and ultimately close the gap. By making Mu a barrier, it makes the koan, the epitome, the condensation of the gap itself. You're working on Mu, the teacher will ask you, what is Mu? And every time you go in for Dokusan, teacher will ask, what is Mu? And whatever you say, he'll shake his head, ring the bell, and out you go. Almost doesn't matter what you say, it's not going to work. Now, one way I like to think about what's going on there is that we're inducing the Zen equivalent of what used to be called in classical Freudian analysis a transference neurosis. In that way of thinking, the relationship with the analyst, who you're seeing five times a week, becomes so intense and so preoccupying, and you get so caught up with the analyst in your issues of competition and comparison and the search for recognition and the craving for his acknowledgement and all the kind of Oedipal rivalry, old Freudians looked for. All that was supposed to get focused on the analyst, and the energy of that sort of sucked out of the rest of your life. It's as if, all the energy would get focused in the analysis, and there'd be none left over to be neurotic with in the rest of your life. It all just get focused right in there. So that once it got focused on the analyst, then when the analyst came up with some ultimately crucial and decisive interpretation, and I remember being told when I was in a class with a classical Freudian that after many, many years of analysis, you might finally be able to say to the patient, I'm not your father. And the crystal would shatter, right? In any case, obviously I'm parodying things, but this is the idea of this kind of put all the focus of your sense of this gap of lack into trying to solve Mu. And then the idea being that not being able to solve Mu sort of carries with it all the pain of feeling inadequate, of not being the real thing, of having something wrong with you, of having some early damage, right? Of being sinful, being stupid, of being weak. Right? All the things that we carry around that we say we're not good enough, we're not the real thing. Well, here's your chance. If you answer Mu, you can be the real thing, right? But every time you try to do it, it doesn't work, right? So over and over again, in a sense, with the teacher, you're faced with the epitome or condensation of all the things that you think is wrong with you and all your failure, over and over and over and over again. And if you do this, you know, the way Mu talks about, and you throw yourself into concentration on Mu, and you let everything in your practice, everything in your life, just be Mu, 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 just every exhalation you put into that. And what he calls is the great doubt, this really ought to be, you know, the cathecting of Mu with all that internal suffering, right? That horrible sense of this isn't it. I'm not it. And then one day, somebody says something or something happens, and it all turns over from this is not it. Suddenly, this is it. Oh, this is it. Nothing has changed. Nothing has happened. But in a certain sense, your whole feeling, your whole perspective shifts in this moment where Mu is just Mu. You're just you. Life is just life. And you can have this enormous sense of release and relief. And this can come in the form of, you know, the kinds of big experiences people write about. But it comes with a catch. And part of the dilemma of practicing this intensely, the plus and minus of it, is you're much more likely to have one of those big fancy experiences than the way we do things here. But the downside of that, and that kind of experience might be, you know, a sense of complete non-separation from the world, right? Of just being one with everything or one with something that's immediately in front of you. And when you're in that kind of non-separation, you have that experience of the perfection of that moment. There's nothing missing. It's complete, it's whole, and it's just as it is. The dilemma is that while that can be extremely intense, it much more often than not is very just focused in that within that experience. And even though Mu is intended to suck into it all the sense of lack and doubt and damage you have in the rest of your life, all too often what happens is you get this sense of everything is fine in that moment, but it's dissociated or sequestered from all that psychological hurt that brings you to practice in the first place. And so you've gotten a very powerful taste of what it feels like to be okay, but you end up very often a very split person, and your okayness gets associated with these experiences, which you then want to have again. And you often, in a kind of unconscious way, set yourself up in your own mind as a very special kind of person now that you've had one of these. And that sort of unconsciously serves as an antidote to the unresolved, sequestered part of yourself that still feels broken and miserable. But if I get special enough, maybe that's bad part will shrink or disappear or at least stay in the closet. So what I'm saying is that when we listen to an old case like this, we should, on the one hand, have great respect for the way it worked and for the way in which it can be a powerful tool for a certain kind of concentration practice that gives the kind of result that we all think we want. But at the same time, we have to bring to it a certain kind of contemporary psychological mindedness that stays aware of the downside and potentially tries to engage the same issues, but from a different kind of way that doesn't lead to that kind of emotional bypass or dissociation. And one of the basic differences in how we practice is instead of trying to put everything into the koan, mu, we try to bring to the surface and stay present to all the things that are latent in the monk's question. Does the dog have a Buddha nature? Do I have Buddha nature? What do I think is lacking? What do I think is out there that I'm trying to attain? And we try to stay more present to the sense of this is not it, that we bring moment after moment to our experience. When Joko had us pay attention to bodily tension or bodily experience of anxiety or anger or judgments, people said, well, that's just psychology. And she said, no, I'm teaching the absolute. You know, she said, this is how I'm teaching you mu. In my own way. I'm trying to have you stay with the very thing you think is not it, the thing that you're here to try to get rid of. And just like with mu, if you stay with that anxiety, stay with the boredom, stay with the pain, stay with the doubt, stay with all the thousand little judgments you make during the day, this is not right. I don't like the way they're doing that. This person's got it all wrong. All these things, if you start attuning to that, you see, you say no to life 1,000 times a day. And mu means no, right? Well, in a way, Joko translated that mu into the little 1,000 no's that you say every day and get you to pay attention to those. Now, Sesshin is this kind of laboratory where I suppose you say we're trying to, as alchemists, turn no into yes. And in a way, what we do in Sesshin is just practice saying yes to everything one moment after another. The form of Sesshin, you know, I often say it's like getting on an escalator. You take the first step, it just carries you through all these experiences. And those experiences include, you know, pain and tedium and you know, all the stuff that happens in Sesshin, all the rituals you don't like and don't understand, all the rules that you think are silly, and why do we do it that way? Why do we do it in Japanese? Everything you have 100 little judgments about, right? Sesshin just carries you through all that stuff. And when I tell you at the beginning of Sesshin, it's important to follow the rules. It's we want to have this kind of automatic yes to every next thing that's happening. Right? That's the form of Sesshin. We just say yes to the next thing over and over and over again. And at the same time, inside, we're watching how we're saying no to everything moment after moment, right? And we're trying to maintain that emotional honesty of the no that we secretly are saying to everything that we are told we're supposed to be saying yes to. Gradually, Sesshin can be wearing out some of that no, 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 no. We find that, or as we sit, just one thing after another comes up. And we want to just stay focused, the physical sensation of sitting, feeling our body breathe, and we daydream and we come back. We're in pain and we come back. The sitting creates the container for just the next moment to show up. And eventually, Sesshin gets us tired of saying no. That usually takes a few days. But it happens. And even in one day, it happens a little bit. And the longer Sesshin, it starts to happen more. Where part of us just gives up and shows up. And the little voice in the back of our head may still be chattering away and complaining and judging. But, you know, as it says in the book, inside gradually becomes outside. We hear the little voice saying, I don't want to do it. And we hear the train whistle. And it turns out that they're not that different. The things going through our head and the things coming in through our ears. It's just stuff, just another sensation, another perception. They all, in some strange way, become equal. And they become equal in the sense that they all become equally empty. The content just doesn't matter anymore, so much anymore. Stuff shows up. We hear it, we think it, we feel it, we see it. The scroll we have hanging here translates something like, don't remove delusion. Don't even seek the truth. Right? That's this kind of radical equality where you stop sorting things into good and bad, into truth and delusion, to problems and solutions, obstacles and path. As we begin, all sorts of things feel like obstacles. The longer we continue, the distinction between the obstacle and the path begins to dissolve.